And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here in the Free Radio Studios suggesting that if you had a pencil and paper handy, you could take down some notes, and that would be one way of making sure that you get to that web page you want, time and place of an event that you like to show up for, things like that. I don't repeat things that often, so... But we have repeated this one a couple of times here. Let's start with announcements. The Midwest Earth First Climbers Guild Camp is coming up August 25th through the 35th. I believe that's next weekend. And the Earth First Climbers Guild sent this out over the Earth First Newswire. Do you like camping in the woods with friends? Do you have a bit of a hero complex? Do you recycle? If you answered yes to any of these questions, you're invited to the Earth First Climbers Guild Climbing Camp in the Driftless area of northern Wisconsin, August 25th through the 31st. The original event was postponed in mid-June, but it's now going to happen. Learn to ascend and descend a rope, tie knots, set anchors, build and raise platforms and other structures, and design creative and effective blockades. You will also learn about rope physics and other tools that will allow you to be the safest, most badass climber in your affinity group. And in order to assist organizers in being as prepared as possible, we're asking people to register in advance. And you can find a registration form and more information at the website efclimbers.net/events. efclimbers.net/events. And if for some reason you still have questions, or if you need relationship advice or hints on cooking or perhaps anything else, email them, driftlessefcg@gmail.com. That's driftlessefcg@gmail.com. And coming up in September is the fall camp out at In the Book Cliffs. I believe this is happening in Utah. It's going to be a weekend of stories and connecting with the land, and this comes from Utah Tar Sands Resistance, as found on the Earth First Newswire. On the weekend of September 19th to 21st, Utah Tar Sands Resistance and friends will be hosting a fall campout in the Book Cliffs. It will be a time for folks from the Uinta Basin, Moab Grand Junction, and other surrounding areas to meet, visit the land, and share stories about regional struggles. There will be fireside chats featuring stories about important regional movements such as the nuclear test site protests and past efforts to halt tar sands mining on the Colorado Plateau. We'll also have bird watching, animal tracking, plant identification walks so that we can get to know the land better, and we'll talk about the indigenous history of the Tavaputs Plateau. We're holding this gathering because we realize we have much to learn from other regional movements. We also realize that sharing stories with one another empowers all of us to take bolder action for a just and livable future. Please join us in strengthening the regional network of people committed to keeping this little planet of ours alive through the deep work of conversation, sharing our experiences, fears, and yes, joys as we talk about what resistance means to us and what gives us hope for the region we love so much. We will be announcing the specific camp site closer to the date. That's late September. But it will be in the PR Springs area. Those of us living on the plateau this summer have discovered a variety of beautiful sites to camp that we are excited to share with you all. We'll post signs prior to the event to make sure everyone can easily find it. Breakfasts and dinners will be provided, but you're going to have to bring your own lunches and snacks. If you have questions, tarsandsresist@riseup.net is their email address. tarsandsresist@riseup.net. And we'll be repeating that announcement for you in upcoming weeks. Here's an update from the sixth week of the Mattole Forest Blockade, and we got this information from Save Mattole's Ancient Forest on the Earth First Newswire. As the logging blockade on Rainbow Ridge in the Mattole nears 6 weeks old, and this was a week ago, The situation has taken an interesting new turn. Tensions are easing as both sides have resumed efforts toward an agreeable resolution. Currently, access for logging and road building remains blocked. Your donations are urgently needed to help forest defenders survey critical forest habitat and to continue to blockade in this rugged terrain. On Monday, August 18th, the Forest Stewardship Council, or FSC, held a public meeting to discuss Humboldt Redwood Company's dubious certification as an environmentally sound at the Monday Club in downtown Fortuna. Humboldt Redwood Company was trying to present its review of logging plans in the Matoll area as acceptable. The entrance to the Matoll area has been blocked by protests for almost a month, and the company is being forced to review the worst aspects of their timber harvest plans. Please be aware that Mike Janai, the president of Humboldt Redwood Company, was until recently a director of the Forest Stewardship Council. And a donation alert, forest defenders are in need of GPS units. Please help the people defending the Matoll Forest by donating new or used GPS units, or donate to PayPal. These devices will allow for more accurate mapping of unlogged and unentered areas and aid in ongoing ground truthing. Thank you for your support. And you can find out all this information at Save the Matoll's Ancient Forest site on Facebook. I don't know how to get there exactly, but I guess you go to Facebook and type in Save the Matoll's Ancient Forest or something like that. And moving to news of activists, Daniel McGowan, environmental activist who was jailed for a Huffington Post blog, has filed a lawsuit against the Bureau of Prisons. In this story by Matt Sledge of the Huffington Post, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Daniel McGowan may have been the first person thrown into solitary confinement for writing a Huffington Post blog. Now he'll be the first person to sue the Bureau of Prisons over it. The environmental activist and former prisoner filed a lawsuit on Wednesday against the prison system over an April 2013 incident in which U.S. Marshals threw him into a Brooklyn federal jail, ironically for criticizing earlier violations of his free speech. The Bureau of Prisons does not like criticism, and their reaction was unsurprisingly to try and crush someone who stepped out of line, McGowan told HuffPost Tuesday in an email. After a federal judge labeled him a terrorist in 2007 for arson committed with the Earth Liberation Front, McGowan spent years in some of the federal prison system's most restrictive prisons, the Communication Management Units, or CMUs. The Bureau of Prisons denies it, but internal prison files strongly suggest McGowan was placed there because of his continued outspoken association with the environmental movement. Serving the final months of his sentence in a Brooklyn halfway house in 2013, McGowan continued to speak out. He detailed how he was placed in the isolated special prisons in a HuffPost blog entry. 3 days after writing that post, the marshals arrested him and threw him in the Brooklyn Metropolitan Detention Center. He was placed in solitary and told that he would soon be taken back to one of the CMUs. Inmates call them Little Guantanamos. I had just served over 5 years in prison and was acclimating to life on the outside only to be yanked back to prison, McGowan said. It was terrifying. After his lawyers interceded, McGowan was released the next day back to the halfway house, but in a separate multi-plaintiff lawsuit against the Bureau of Prisons for how it creates and runs CMUs, McGowan's lawyers argued the entire incident was a startling example of their larger claim that the special units are used to punish political speech. Even the federal government later admitted in that case that McGowan was jailed contrary to the established law that inmates may write articles under their own bylines. Although a judge dismissed McGowan's claims in the lawsuit against the CMUs in July of last year, he is now forging on against the Bureau of Prisons for what he says was a clear case of unconstitutional retaliation. McGowan was arrested for his criticism of the government, plain and simple, his lawyer David Rankin told HuffPost in an email. Communication management units are wrong now. They were wrong then. And trying to tell that to the world should not get you thrown back in prison. And mink have been released from a Quebec fur farm in this story from the Canadian broadcast company News, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Wildlife officials say hundreds and possibly more than 1,000 mink are on the loose from a St. Hyacinthe area fur farm after an intruder broke in and opened cages. The farm in St. Jude, about 75 kilometers northeast of Montreal, was the subject of numerous media reports last week after the Montreal SPCA reported foxes and minks living in what they alleged were inhumane conditions. At the time of the reports, many mink farm owners expressed concern that their operations would be targeted by anti-fur activists as a result. The farm owner, Jean-Luc Rodier, refused to speak to CBC News. The head of the Canadian Fur Council said the released mink would likely not survive long in the wild. Alan Herskovici said that many of the animals would likely be hit by cars because they're attracted to the sound of engines, which they mistake for the feeding mechanisms back on the farms. We've seen other cases when mink are released like this irresponsibly. Most of the mink are killed, he told CBC News. He also said the mink are aggressive and it is possible the released animals will attack other, smaller animals. Yes, they are carnivorous. And the United States has denied protections for wolverines, outraging conservationists, in this story by Laura Zuckerman, with editing by Daniel Wallace and Sandra Mahler, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. U.S. wildlife managers on Tuesday denied federal protections for rare wolverines, outraging conservationists but pleasing Western states that opposed adding the reclusive but feisty member of the weasel family to the endangered and threatened species list. Last year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed applying Endangered Species Act safeguards for the estimated 300 wolverines left in the lower 48 states, most of which inhabit the high country of Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. The service had said global warming was reducing mountain snows the animals used to dig dens and store food. But on Tuesday, federal wildlife managers said there was insufficient evidence that climate change would harm wolverines, which resemble small bears with bushy tails and which are known for their ferocious defense of their young. After carefully considering the best available science, the service has determined that the effects of climate change are not likely to place the wolverine in danger of extinction now or in the foreseeable future, Fish and Wildlife Service spokesperson Gavin Shire said in a statement. The decision was welcomed in states such as Montana, which will determine next year whether to reinstate a limited wolverine trapping season, which was suspended in 2012 after a lawsuit by conservationists. Listing would have banned trapping of wolverines, which are prized for their fur, and imposed restrictions on snowmobiling and other winter recreation in areas inhabited by the solitary creatures. Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director for the Center for Biological Diversity, says Tuesday's decision was part of a disturbing trend by the Obama administration of managing imperiled wildlife based on pressure by states and industry instead of science. All of the science points to the wolverine being in serious trouble. The service's own biologist said global warming was pushing the wolverine towards extinction and urged listing, Noah said. And emerging solar power plants scorch birds in midair, in this story from the Associated Press, as printed in the Washington Post and posted on the Earth First Newswire. Workers at a state-of-the-art solar power plant in the Mojave Desert, near Ivanpah, have a name for birds that fly through the plant's concentrated sun rays. Streamers, for the black smoke plume that comes from the birds that ignite in midair. For federal wildlife investigators who visited the Bright Source Energy plant last year and watched as birds burned and fell reported an average of one streamer every 2 minutes. Are urging California officials to halt the operator's application to build a still bigger version. The investigators want the halt until the full extent of the deaths can be assessed. Estimates per year now range from a low of about 1,000, according to BrightSource, up to 28,000 as estimated by an expert for the Center for Biological Diversity Environmental Group. The deaths are alarming. It's hard to say whether that's the location or the technology, said Gary George, renewable energy director for the California chapter of the Audubon Society, but there needs to be some caution. The bird kills mark the latest instance in which the quest for clean energy sometimes has inadvertent environmental harm. Solar farms have been criticized for their impacts on desert tortoises, and wind farms have killed birds, including numerous raptors. We take this issue very seriously, said Jeff Holland, a spokesperson for NRG Solar of Carlsbad, California, the second of three companies behind the plant. The third, Google, deferred comment to its partners. The $2.2 billion plant, which launched in February, is at Ivanpah Dry Lake near the California-Nevada border. The operator says it's the world's biggest plant to employ so-called power towers. More than 300,000 mirrors, each the size of a garage door, reflect solar rays into three boiler towers, each looming up to 40 stories high. The water inside is heated to produce steam, which turns turbines that generate enough electricity for 140,000 homes. Sun rays sent up by the field of mirrors are bright enough to dazzle pilots flying in and out of Las Vegas and Los Angeles. Federal wildlife officials said Ivanpah might act as a mega trap for wildlife, with the bright light of the plant attracting insects, which in turn attract insect-eating birds that fly to their deaths in the intensely focused light rays. Federal and state biologists call the number of deaths significant, based on sightings of birds getting singed and falling, and on the retrieval of carcasses with feathers charred too severely for flight. Ivanpah officials dispute the source of the so-called streamers, saying at least some of the puffs of smoke mark insects and bits of airborne trash being ignited by the solar rays. Wildlife officials who witnessed the phenomena say many of the clouds of smoke were too big to come from anything but a bird, and they add that they saw birds entering the solar flux and igniting, and consequently becoming a streamer. U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials say they want a death toll for a full year of operation. Given the apparent scale of bird deaths at Ivanpah, authorities should thoroughly track bird kills there for a year, including during annual migratory seasons, before granting any more permits for that kind of solar technology, said George of the Audubon Society. The toll on birds has been surprising, said Robert Weisenmuller, chairman of the California Energy Commission. We didn't see a lot of impact on birds at the first smaller power towers in the U.S. and Europe, Weisenmuller added. The commission is now considering the application from Oakland-based BrightSource to build a mirror field and a 75-story power tower that would reach above the sand dunes and creek washes between Joshua Tree National Park and the California-Arizona border. The proposed plant is on a flight path for birds between the Colorado River and California's largest lake, the Salton Sea, an area experts say is richer in avian life than the Ivanpah plant, with protected golden eagles and peregrine falcons and more than 100 other species of birds being recorded there. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officials warned California this month that the power tower style of solar technology holds the, quote, highest lethality potential, unquote, of the many solar projects burgeoning in the deserts of California. The commission's staff estimates the proposed new tower would be almost four times as dangerous to birds as the Ivanpah plant. The agency is expected to decide this autumn on the proposal. And a coal export permit has been denied in the Pacific Northwest in this story from the Columbia Riverkeeper, and found on the Earth First Newswire. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber and the Oregon Department of State Lands Director Mary Abrams finally said no to coal exports. The Oregon Department of State Lands denied a key permit necessary for Ombre Energy's Morro Pacific coal export proposal. Ombre's dirty coal project would have sent hundreds of coal trains through the region, thousands of coal barges down the Columbia River, and further disrupted our climate with dangerous carbon pollution. The Oregon Department of State Lands decision is a defining win for clean water, salmon, and our communities. The decision deals a severe blow to Ombre Energy's struggling proposal. The decision also marks the first time a Pacific Northwest state agency formally rejected a coal export facility. The denial comes on the heels of Ombre Energy's repeated failures to provide information to the Oregon Department of State Lands about the project's scope and impacts. Ombre Energy would use the terminal to ship over 8 million tons of coal annually along the Columbia River and through the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. Northwest families will accept nothing less than the kind of leadership that protects our health, safety, economy, and climate, said Mike Seeley of Seeley Family Farms. Coal exports would devastate my business and jeopardize many other family operations and industries that depend on a healthy, clean Columbia River. Today's decision shows that Oregon families and leaders agree the threats of coal exports are far too risky for our economies and natural resources. Over the past several months, more than 20,000 citizens have contacted Governor Kitzhaber requesting a denial of the permit. In May, 86 elected officials from Oregon, Montana, Idaho, and Washington urged Governor Kitzhaber and the Oregon Department of State Lands to protect frontline communities throughout the Northwest by rejecting a permit for Ombre Energy's proposed Morro Pacific coal export project. Close to 600 Northwest businesses and business leaders have also either expressed concern or outright opposition to the coal exports. More than 3,000 medical professionals and public health advocates have requested a denial of the Morro Pacific Project permit. Coal contains toxins like lead and arsenic known to harm human health. In addition to dangerous diesel exhausts from barges, trains, and ships, toxic coal dust will threaten air quality and worsen asthma, respiratory illnesses, and other health problems. Over 165 Oregon physicians voiced their concerns directly to Governor Kitzhaber in the position statement on coal exports from concerned Oregon physicians to Governor Kitzhaber. Excuse me. Ombre Energy has been plagued by financial questions and has made little progress in obtaining state or federal permits. Earlier this year, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality announced Ombre Energy's proposal to build a coal export terminal will require an additional water quality permit known as a 401 water quality certification. To date, the agency has received a record-breaking 16,500 public comments on Ombre's proposal. Further north, opposition to Washington state coal export projects also remains strong. This month, faith leaders and the Lummi tribe will hold a cross-country journey to consolidate opposition among key stakeholder groups that would help shape a trajectory of the proposed coal export facility at Cherry Point in Bellingham, Washington. And South Africa to combat poaching by moving Kruger rhinos in this story by Ed Stoddard, with editing by Ed Cropley and Allison Williams, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. South Africa plans to move up to 500 rhinos from its flagship Kruger National Park to counter a wave of poaching of the animals for their horns, highly prized in the newly affluent Asian countries as a sign of wealth. Officials said on Tuesday the mission could see some of the animals shipped to nearby Botswana and Zambia as South Africa grapples with a poaching epidemic that has seen more than 630 rhinos killed so far this year, 408 of them in Kruger National Park. "We have to take the rhinos to where they are safe," Marcus Hoffmeyer, head vet for the national park, told a news briefing. The latest census from the Kruger shows it has between 8,400 and 9,600 white rhinos. Despite the poaching, the population has stabilized with an annual mortality rate including poaching of around 8%, which is matched by an 8% birth rate. The removals will be a huge operation that will involve tracking down the animals in rugged and remote bush, then darting them with tranquilizers from helicopters. Moving just one animal could cost $1,500 or more. It is a mammoth task. We are looking to numbers of up to 500, Environment Minister Edna Molewa told Reuters. We must start soon. Kruger Rangers move some rhinos every year, with park management using the proceeds from sales to private reserves to help fund conservation efforts. A record 250 rhinos were moved in 2009, but the scale of the poaching problem has forced it to take a more drastic approach, Hoffmeyer said. The focus of the operation will be on Kruger's eastern border with Mozambique, one of the world's poorest countries, where poachers from impoverished communities are lured by the promise of quick money. Botswana, in particular, may be an ideal base for relocated rhinos because it has vast areas of sparsely populated and inaccessible wilderness. South Africa is the epicenter of a surge in poaching over the last few years because it is home to the vast majority of the world's population, 18,000 white rhinos and 3,000 black ones. More than 1,000 were poached last year, three times the tally in 2010, to meet soaring demand for rhino horn, coveted as an ingredient in traditional medicine in fast-growing economies such as China and Vietnam. According to the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, which monitors trade in wildlife products, there has also been a shift from medicinal use to flaunting rhino horn as a sign of wealth. Its street value is estimated by some conservationists at $65,000 a kilogram, making it more valuable than platinum or gold. Elsewhere in Africa, elephants are being poached at an alarming rate for the ivory in their tusks, while another species, the pangolin, a kind of anteater, is hunted because its scales are a prized fashion product and its meat a delicacy. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock, right here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of this or this broadcast, please tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you're in the Moscow, Idaho area, tune in to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, at 90.3 FM, Monday nights at 9:30. Or on the internet, go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. Search for Earth First. Don't forget the exclamation point update. And you can listen there, or you can download the shows. I want to thank you for listening to the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.